This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley.
Put more impediments into a citizen's right, a legal citizen's right to vote, and make that more difficult. You impede the natural right of democracy.
That's former governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, talking about Florida's restrictive law, which will keep registered voters from casting a ballot because of the law and some of the details of the law in Florida. Think about how you'd feel if you show up at the polls this November only to be turned away, either because your polling place is closed or you don't have the right idea. These are just some of the realities of what's called voter suppression. And joining me are two people who think a lot about this, Alex Kasar and Aaron O'Brien. Alex Kasar is at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he is the professor of social policy and history. And Aaron O'Brien is a professor of political science at UMass Boston. Thank you both for being here.
It's a pleasure to be on.
You can join the conversation at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Has it ever been hard for you to vote? Do you think this is much ado about nothing? Is democracy working? Do you think it's broken? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You can send us a tweet at Boss Public Radio. So, Alex Kasar, you've been talking about voting and all of its aspects for years and years. And in fact, one of your books is about how democracy is always contested. And so we should not be surprised that we are at a time and point where there are a number of these restrictive laws that fall under what we call voter suppression. Why is that?
I wish I could give you a very simple answer to that. I mean, since I've been working on this for years and years, and I still haven't solved the problem. But I think that if we look at our very broad political and social situation, and think about other periods in the American past when voter suppression or vote suppression has also reared its head in sort of powerful form, I think we see a couple of common characteristics. One is that this is a period of nationally close partisan rivalry. In national elections, the chambers of Congress as well as the presidency can change hands. Elections are expected to be close. And the other is that this is a period of high levels of immigration with a lot of new and, quotes, different people entering the polity and potentially voting. And it is also, and here's a similarity, I think, to be pondered and thought about, the other major period when voter suppression was very visible, of course, came at the late 19th century. And it happened in the North, targeted at immigrants. But it also happened in the South, targeted at African-American freed slaves who, for a period of 10 or 20 years after the Civil War and after the passage of constitutional amendments, had been allowed to vote. We're now in a period a couple of generations after the Voting Rights Act is passed. So what we have are high levels of participation in elections, or sometimes high levels on the part of African Americans, new waves of immigration, the poor, who generally have been the targets of voter suppression tactics over the last century, are people who look somewhat different to some people's eyes. Who are somewhat different, and we have close elections. I think those dynamics they don't guarantee leading to waves of laws such as those we've seen, but it creates a kind of underlying set of circumstances.
It's important to note that 33 states now require ID for voting. These are for registered voters, just want everybody to understand, and 5 states require a specific kind of photo ID. And here's what voter suppression in all of its manifestations looks like. It means that laws restrict early voting, reduce the voting hours, close precincts before the election day, change locations so some people can't go to the same locations they'd been going to before, can't reach the new ones, eliminating same-day registration, and then, of course, the photo ID laws require photo IDs and prevent the use, by the way, of student IDs and other forms of ID in some cases needed. You have to have a specific kind of photo ID in a number of these states. That's what it looks like on the ground. Now, to the point of voter turnout, which Alex Kasar just mentioned, Aaron O'Brien. That's the point, right? Because you have written in your latest paper about this, how close the election is this year.
Indeed. And what the analysis you're alluding to, myself and a co-author, Keith Bentel, also at UMass Boston, and I looked at what the professor just said in the modern era. So we looked at from 2005 to 2011, which states proposed the legislation you just enumerated and which states passed. And interestingly enough, 90% of states have proposed the photo IDs, the proof of citizenship, absentee ballot restrictions, something like that. And 50 states have passed, added to the books, additional legislation. And so what we were interested in is that same question, the longstanding debate really in political science, in really tight and contested elections, do political parties try to get new folks to the party? Do they serve this like grand democratic vision of, okay, tight election, let's get more people involved in the democratic process. Let's bring new people in, understanding that that might rock the boat a little bit with your core constituency, or do they try to demobilize? Do they try to keep others from the other guy's party from coming out? And so we simply looked at, we did fancy math, as I call it in class, but a lot of statistical analysis where we controlled for all the explanations on the right and the left and in political science for why is it that states would propose and or pass. And for proposal, not surprisingly, I think unfortunately from the democratic process, we found consistently that it's the percent of Republicans in the state legislature. And then we found the change in class bias and turnout, meaning that as low-income people turn out more relative or that they increase their return rates compared to more affluent. So they still vote less, but they're turning out more. In the last election, proposal was more likely, and we also found out same with minority turnout.
So let me, if I could go back to the class bias thing that you focused on in your paper about low income residents and citizens who should be registered to vote. What happened here in Massachusetts, both of you are aware of recently, led by a charge by Senator Scott Brown. He objected to the sending of information to specifically targeted low-income residents, saying this was a waste of taxpayers' money and it was political as a way to get more Democratic votes. In fact, this is the law. And the sending of that information was to respond to the law because it had not been followed. So just to be clear as to what was happening, and this is why. And so the focus on low-income citizens, as you've outlined in your paper, is really quite a battle now in many of the battleground states.
It's perfectly in keeping with that. Now, I mean, for a lot of the, you know, go back to your fifth grade civics class, voting was a good thing. Right.
Yeah.
But in the modern political era, what's that debate with Scott Brown and Demos and the Warren campaign is certainly in keeping with what we found in 2008. Low income people did not turn out more than higher income people in Massachusetts, by no means. But they made some inroads. And our analysis found in the 50 states that when that happens, the proposal and then the passage of this kind of legislation is more likely. And so what's happening with Scott Brown in that debate is emblematic, unfortunately, I would say, of what's going on across the 50 states, or it's at least a representative story.
Alex Kasar?
Yeah, I just want to add a little bit of context to that, which is that most, not all, but most or many of the measures that you talked about, characterizing them as aptly as voter suppression, are responses to political and legal measures that have been adopted over the last 25 years to try to increase turnout among poor people. The National Voter Registration Act, commonly known as the Motor Voter Bill, was designed to do precisely that. And that, in turn, was a response to people's having noticed that from the 1960s on, turnout in general was declining or at best stagnant, and that there's what was and remains a very significant gap between the voter participation rates of the middle and upper middle classes and the working class and the poor. So what we're seeing now now is there were a series of measures such as early voting, such as using public agencies to encourage registration. Those measures were all adopted, and to some degree, they're working. And now I think what we're seeing is a pushback against those measures that are designed to make it easier for the less advantaged members of our society to register and vote.
So the most recent ruling, because the laws are in place in these states, as I've mentioned. Now, not only the federal government in by way of the Department of Justice, but also other groups have brought lawsuits to say that people are being prevented to have access to as American citizens to exercise a privilege that's held dear for many American citizens. Most recently in Pennsylvania, this was last week, Judge Robert Simpson ruled that the new voter ID law requiring all the citizens to produce a state-issued or state-sanctioned photo ID at the polls, he said, was he did not believe was going to cause a disenfranchisement, and he did not believe that disenfranchisement was, quote, immediate or inevitable. In other words, this did not place an undue burden, those again are his words, on citizens to get extra identification. Now, again, I want to emphasize these are people registered, people who have been voting. And I want us to take a listen to one of the plaintiffs in the case. There were 11 plaintiffs who said this does pose a burden. One of them was 93-year-old Viviette Applewhite. She's been voting since Kennedy was in office. Here's what she thinks about it.
I think it stinks. That's what I do. I just think it's really absolutely, I think it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of, who did not want people to have a piece of paper to vote. I've never heard anything like it before. And I just think it's terrible because there's so many people that don't have ID and they're not going to be able to vote. And that's taken, I think that's taken their privilege away from them. I don't think it's right.
To be clear, she lost all of her vital papers. Her purse was stolen. She's been trying to get it replaced, Alex Kasar, and can't make it happen. And she's determined. She's a person trying to get it happening. And she doesn't have this extra ID known as PennDOT for Pennsylvania. She's just out of luck for the first time since Kennedy.
And she will be joined by a significant number of other people. We don't know how many other people, but I think she's a classic instance of one kind of person. I mean, a number of years ago, after Indiana passed one of the first of these laws, there was a celebrated case where a number of elderly nuns showed up at the polls, and they were in similar circumstances. They didn't drive, or they had given up their driver's licenses, and they were not permitted to vote.
Now, the reason that these laws were issued in place, the ostensible reason, and mostly in Republican-run legislatures and states where Republicans are in office, this is not a slam against Republicans, this is the fact. So just want everybody to know that, is because they said it was voter fraud was at stake. And in Pennsylvania, even though in the case brought before the judge, there was not one case. That means to say zero cases of fraud to be brought forth, that the judge still said, well, even with that, I'm going to say it's not going to pose an undue burden. I should note that in Pennsylvania, 759,000 people at this point have no ID, and a third of the people in Pennsylvania do not know the laws have changed. That brings me back to the politics of this, Aaron O'Brien, and that is Republicans focusing on this kind of legislation. It started in 2003. Some people are thinking maybe it started after President Obama was elected. In fact, some of these state laws were enacted then. It's been going on up until 2011, and we've just talked about what's going on here. Lots of Democrats and others have suggested that this is politically motivated to reduce the turnout for people who potentially could vote for Democrats. I think people need to hear from what some GOP leaders have said. And here is a soundbite from the former chairman of Florida's GOP, Jim Greer, when he admitted and said outright that the Republican strategy is to reduce minority voting.
There's no doubt that what the Republican-led legislature in Florida and Governor Scott are trying to do is make sure that the Republican Party has an advantage in this upcoming election by reducing early voting, putting roadblocks up for potential voters, Latinos, African Americans, to register and then to exercise their right to vote. There's no doubt. I was in the room. It's part of the strategy.
All right, so Erin O'Brien, that's not me, that's not you, that's the former chair of the Florida GOP saying this is the plan, though many have denied it.
Indeed, many have denied it. You know, Ken Blackwell and some others, Dennis Prager from the National Review, have said differently, that, you know, that this is a common sense measure of voter ID to curtail fraud. And the challenge, as you alluded to, is... Democrats are saying this is demobilizing our core constituency. It's not by accident that minorities and low-income people are going to be hurt the most by this in young folks who are our core constituency. Speaking to the politics of it, though, you know, to say we're curtailing fraud, even though fraud is, there's been a Lorraine Minute documents all fraud that goes on. It's like 0.00003. But if there's a narrative out there that fraud is going on and fraud is rampant, the narrative can become a lot more powerful than the facts. And many Republicans, certainly not all, have responded with, if you do fraud well, you can't count it. So now we've got something that's unmeasurable. And if you just say it's going on enough, then from that perspective, if you really believe fraud is real, even though we can't measure it or we don't find it, then these laws make more sense. Now, the original person that you had put up there was more forthright that, listen, elections are really ugly, and we're going to do what we can to win within legal means. And so the politics are a lot different than the actual facts on this particular case when it comes to fraud.
That's my guest, Erin O'Brien. She's a professor of political science at UMass Boston. We are talking about voter suppression, that are state laws put in place to reduce access to the ballot for registered voters. That's the key. I'm also here with Alex Kasar. He's at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's a professor of social policy and government and has written much and studied voting patterns throughout the years. Now, in a recent piece you wrote, Alex Kasar, you said, hey, it's reasonable to try to stop voter fraud, any potential, even if it's minuscule voter fraud. And it's even reasonable to require people to have extra ID. But your point is how it should be done.
Yeah, no, that's right. And just to be clear, that's in the context of I completely agree with everything that's just been said about the fact that these laws are designed to solve a problem which doesn't seem to happen. But I do think we should recognize and that the idea of having a voter ID card, to my mind at least, is not objectionable in itself. In most countries in the world, you either have a voter ID card or a national identification card, and people use that in order to vote. And it's conceivable in some circumstances that it would prevent voter fraud. I mean, I don't think we can pretend that voter fraud is something that could never happen, although it hasn't happened in Pennsylvania or Indiana or any of the states, or in-person voter fraud, impersonation fraud. My point in that piece is to say that if you're really concerned about that, you could create a system where everybody in the country has an ID. But what you do is not say that it's up to the 93-year-old woman to go find it and get her papers. It's not her responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the 19-year-old poor young man who doesn't have a driver's license either. It's the responsibility of public authorities of the state or of the federal government to ensure that every person who is supposed to has a national ID. And there will be a variety of ways, you know, of doing that, where the state, you know, takes responsibility, actively goes out and distributes these. Or another mechanism, which I suggested in that piece, was you could create a system where if you show up at the polls and you don't have an ID, You cast a provisional ballot, which would be counted if you turn out to be legit. And while you're doing that, while you're at the polls, you apply for your ID, which would then, again, they could check it out and be mailed to you 2 weeks later, and then you would have your ID. That would be costly to the state or to the federal government for a period of time. But the end result of that would be to get everybody with an ID and to end this problem. I guess my view is that, well, if you really want to have a system like that, let's do it this way and not disfranchise anybody along the way. And that would be possible to do.
Now, as what we know is that Rhode Island, our neighbors, have enacted one of these laws in place, and they have as a part of the formula for making people come up with additional ID by the state, a provisional ballot a proposal, as you have just described. But what I've heard, Alex Kasar, by some is that often those provisional ballots don't end up getting counted. And this is what makes a lot of people nervous. So I go, the state says they're going to help me, as Rhode Island says it's going to do. And then in the end, my vote still is not counted because I had to have this extra thing. And by the way, I was already registered to vote.
No, I mean, look, it is not a foolproof system. I think we're going to see how Rhode Island's system works. It's true that provisional ballots often are not counted. They're certainly not counted if the margin of victory in the state is larger than the number of provisional ballots. So there are hazards there. But I guess my point is that we could think about developing a method for doing this that might still have some glitches, but would have some chance of working. That would certainly be better than the kinds of laws that are being put on the books right now.
So, according to the Brennan Center at New York University, 11% of people have no ID across the country, and the potential is that 5 million people will lose their vote, lose their opportunity to vote, Aaron O'Brien. And this is very distressing to any number of folks who care about this. And more to the point, in those states where they have instituted outreach programs as a part and parcel of the state law, they're supposed to tell people that the law has changed. A lot of people don't know. A third of the people in Pennsylvania do not know the law has changed at this point.
Indeed. And it becomes low-income individuals are less likely to vote anyway. And we know, as the professor was alluding, that it's really hard to figure out the DMV. It's really hard to figure out a lot of these connections with government. And when you've got 50 states and then all the localities within the states administering elections differently, most individuals are worried about their jobs or trying to find a job or other things like that. Trying to stay on top of the right to vote, which is something that most individuals perceive as nonpartisan, right? Mm. I might not like the way my neighbor votes, but I don't want to keep him or her from the poll. So I think there's one of the places we tend to have actually more confidence in government is when it comes to the right to vote. Even felony disenfranchisement laws, when individuals are willing to be very difficult on prison sentencing and how long you have to remain in jail and all those things. Felony voting is actually one of those places that most people want to restore the right to vote to felons. So it speaks to this idea that the right to vote is held as quite sacred. It's good government. It's civics. It's all these things that on the right and the left we tend to like. So the idea that you have to keep up with the proper paperwork, it's hard enough to get there on a Tuesday in the middle of November or the beginning of November.
If it's raining, forget it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And, oh, my polling place changed, and I can only get there on my lunch break, or what if I work the overnight? There's so many other things that make it difficult that most Americans aren't paying attention to the nitty-gritty of what papers do I need, at what time frame do I need, right? Like, I very much agree with Alex that we could have a universal voting card. That's not that difficult.
India has one,
yes,
by the way.
Yes,
yes. They issued one. They issue one to every citizen.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, oh, yes, you can vote. You don't have, you know, all of us or not all of us. Many of us have moved. And when you move, you got to redo it. We make it really hard to vote in the United States. And this is yet another layer of difficulty when, you know, I always say to my students, we could do elections different days. We could have a much more uniform process. Why don't we and what implications does that have? So, and all the things I think we're talking about today are a case, a very important, large case of that issue.
So before we draw this conversation to a close, there's a question that I want to ask both of you to your point, Aaron, and that is we do have in our Constitution various amendments that address can't discriminate on race, can't discriminate on gender. 18-year-olds get a right to vote. I mean, we have a lot of attention in the Constitution already to voting. And we have, in addition to that, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which very specifically says you cannot, you know, demonstrate again, because we had to go through the Civil Rights Movement to get this race, gender, and people in a language minority group. That's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. How are we here? I'm not understanding why this is, why we're having these kinds of, why are these laws? I don't get it, Alex Kasar.
Well, I'd say there are two, there are two things there. The first is the sobering fact that despite the amendments that you referred to, there is not an affirmative right to vote in the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution does not say anywhere that anybody has a right to vote. The 19th Amendment does not say that women have a right to vote. There's nowhere does it say African Americans have a right to vote. The law says that you can't deny someone the right to vote for particular reasons. So that the major articulated constitutional protections for the right to vote are not nearly as firm as they could be. You may remember that in the debates in the Supreme Court in 2000, Bush v. Gore, Justice Scalia famously sort of interrogating Al Gore's lawyer said, but there is no right to vote for president under Article 2 of the Constitution, is there? And indeed, the decision in that case articulated that the presidential elections are an extreme case. In presidential elections, for example, we have no right to vote for president unless our state legislature decides that electors will be chosen by a popular election. And the state legislature could decide not to. So, you know, starting point one is that I think we have, compared to almost all modern democracies, we have weak constitutional protections for the right to vote, and we have an extremely decentralized system, which was created really at the outset, where most matters having to do with voting operate at the state level. And that leaves a lot of wiggle room for conflict over procedures and processes, which could, in the end, turn out to prevent people from voting.
Last word, Aaron.
I would say today that what is an undue burden is very hard to articulate. And that undue to vote. And then we add in, as was brought up, the politics of implementation times federalism. So it's really complicated. Add that we don't have an affirmative right. And what is an undue burden? Most of the people deciding what an undue burden have less undue burdens, right? And then we add in, I think, really what's going on with politics and tight elections and political parties. What we're experiencing today isn't new. The groups have changed, as we opened with. The other is threatening oftentimes in American politics. And while we love the right to vote, we don't like it sometimes when those folks have changed historically. But I think political parties in this area, we've got tight elections. And if you bring new people into your party repeatedly, you've got some constituencies that might not get along. An immigrant vote and the Republican Party. There are potential sources of conflict there. It's easier in some ways, it's less disruptive to the core of your party to suppress the vote on the other side. I happen to not think that's normatively good, but it is politics. And so while there's a disjuncture between what we think about voting and how we hold it up high and the way it has played out historically, and today is a very visible case of that.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I will note that the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and other groups have joined together to put together an app So anyone can go to the app to find out, are you registered? What do you have extra stuff that you have to do in your state to make certain you can vote in the upcoming elections? And obviously, as those of us who encourage voting, encourage people to check that out. Alex Kasar, Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Professor of Social Policy and Government, thank you so much. And Aaron O'Brien, Professor of Political Science, UMass Boston, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you very much.
The preferred food for newborn babies is their mother's breast milk. But what happens if a mother is unable to give her newborn milk? Some mothers turn to donated breast milk. We'll take a look at a new breast milk donation center located on the South Shore that is the first of its kind in New England.